हम प्रपोजन का सूचना मैं विशाल विस्तार विस्तार जी का बोलो जी I've been sitting in this chair since 1999. The first time that we had two venues at the same time. I must indicate that I also started there and then came back here. So I think there was a factor, they ran away from those issues. but to us, we are very appreciative that you are here. We are going to be having two presentations. Please welcome an old friend of mine, Bushipo. I think he's come a long way. yes. And I think it's the first time that they are coming to the lead of the NSY. And there are many people who are coming here in acting capacity. I hope this should not be reflecting this committee. That in your very first time that you are coming, things are in as this orderly. I understand the CAC is the first to make the presentation. our time now, we have a time for things. The time is already about 25 past. and one is possibly to be out of here by 12:30 at the latest. Which means we need to divide the time that we're having. 10:30, 11:30, 12:30. Which means if we agree, can we agree to have both presentation and discussion within 1 hour for each presentation? So at 11:30, whether we are true or not, whether there are questions that have been asked, I'll cut off from CAE and cross over to NSY. So even at NSY's at 12:30, we'll cut off, so we'll make your presentation, allow us to make comments, and then within that given time period, I'm sorry for that. I'll hand over there for now to the CHE. They'll introduce themselves and make the presentation.
Can I see red? Can I see red? Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The CAC is represented here today by myself as acting CEO and my colleagues, Mr. Bengu, who is the acting deputy executive director of the GPC, and my colleague Dr. Jan Bukos, who is our chief financial officer. We send our presentation and a briefing for the committee beforehand, and so I'm going to go pretty fast through the presentation, if that's okay. As the committee knows, the CSP has four areas of responsibilities that were given to it with the creation of the council in 1997. The four areas of responsibility are just advising the Minister of Education, and that is done on the Minister's request or proactively. The second function is to monitoring the state of the higher education system and the achievement of policy objectives. The third function is our executive function, which is exercised by the Higher Education Quality Committee, which is assuring and promoting quality in higher education. And our fourth function is to contribute to the development of higher education, which is a very broad function that basically we understand it to be increasing the debate in higher education. In terms of our first area of responsibility, the 2006-2007 year was a very good year for the CAC. And what was very important for us was that the Minister of Education came to the CAC and addressed the council and provided a very interesting and sharp presentation on what were the government priorities and what were the concerns that the ministry had in terms of higher education. Taking that as a basis, we have done a combination of ministerial priority areas and the work awards already underway at CAG. In terms of the advice that was requested directly by the minister, the CAG had to comment on the National Policy Framework for Teacher Education and Development, and we've been part, like many other colleagues in the sector, in the debate about the Higher Education Qualification Framework, and we advised the minister about the promulgation of the document. In terms of proactive advice to the minister, there are a number of projects which are still ongoing. One of them is focused on the barriers to access and an equal opportunity of outcome. And there's been a very interesting project, and we are hoping that next year we should be able to present a full report. The funding and financing of higher education is an ongoing area of investigation and advice. The third area is the macro implementation of institutional restructuring and the impact, outcomes, and consequences that the restructure of higher education has had. And this is, as you may imagine, an ongoing project. And the last project that we are involving in this area has to do with advising the minister in terms of the involvement that government has had in the regulation of higher education and whether that has had an impact in terms of academic freedom and institutional autonomy. And we are awaiting the report from the task team that the CAG constituted by March next year. In the area of monitor and evaluation, As you probably know from previous presentations that have been made to this committee, that the CAG has developed a particular methodology to try and understand how higher education institutions fare in relation to the policy objectives. And that the area in the CAG which is responsible for that is the monitor and evaluation direction. So during the 2006-2007 year, we produce a number of these profiles of higher education institutions, which you have listed in the documentation that was handed over to you before. These reports are very important for us because they constitute analytical tools that, on the one hand, help the work of the Higher Education Policy Committee, but also allow us to understand better how the higher education sector is performing. In general, this things function at the input and output level and focus only on teaching and learning and research. And we work then, thanks to the support and that our colleagues in the Department of Education provide for us, because it is done based fundamentally on HEMIS and SAPSI data. Then in terms of the research that the Monitor and Evaluation Directorate does, we have finalized a research-based publication called Review of Higher Education that has focused on a number of important issues. The financing of higher education, issues of access of non-traditional students, issues of governance and regulation, issues of institutional culture, and finally a reflection on how change does take place in higher education. Then we are in the process of finalizing a very important piece of research on the relationship between institutional culture and the success of a student, which we've done on a 3 case study basis that refer to the University of Pretoria, the University of the Witwatersrand, and the University of the Western Cape. And we have a very large and still ongoing project on the state of postgraduate education in the country, which we hope is going to end in a very interesting report to be published by March next year. In terms of the work of the Higher Education Quality Committee, The work of the APQC covers three fundamental areas in terms of its responsibility. The accreditation of programs that we see in terms of the accreditation of new programs and the accreditation of programs that are already existed and is what we call national reviews, institutional audits, and quality promotion and capacity development. The APQC also, because of its work and because of its links to other organizations, to other sort of agencies of quality assurance, either in the continent or in Europe or in America, also has very important international relations, and we take these things very, very seriously too. I'm going to refer only to the main areas of function. If the members have any questions about international relations, I'm happy to answer. In the area of program accreditation, the work of the CQC in this area is fundamentally routine work in a sense. We assess new programs that are submitted by public and private providers of higher education, and we try to ensure that the quality of these programs is such that institutions can start offering those programs and produce graduates that are reputable. The APQC has in this area also a coordinating role in relation to other EPQAs in the system. And last year we made what we think was a major breakthrough in the sense that we signed our first memorandum of understanding with one professional association, which in this case was the Engineering Council of South Africa. And this was done more than just in the paper, in the act of signing. This was backed by a very interesting framework to of cooperation to do quality assurance with EXA, which we hope is going to have an influence in the rest of the work that we do. In the area of institutional audit, as you know, the APQC has a responsibility of conducting audits of public higher education institutions fundamentally. And when it comes to private higher education institutions, we only audit a few of them. And this has to do with the fact that many of these institutions are very new, some are very small, some are sort of single-purpose institutions. So, in a sense, they are not auditable with the kind of framework that we have, but we sort of look into the quality of institutions from a different perspective. However, those institutions that are large enough and that have been around for a few years are audited. Among those institutions, we audited Da Vinci and Monash SA. And in the case of Monash SA, it was a joint audit between the APQC and our colleagues in Australia, the Australian Quality Assurance Agency. In terms of the local institutions that we and public higher education institutions that we audited the Valley University of Technology, we audited West University, and we audited the University of the Free State, all of which have received the audit report and they are with the Vice Chancellor for comment. Members might be wondering why did we audit the Polytechnic of Namibia. This has to do with an old relationship that South Africa had through CERTEC that used to audit and help with the quality assurance of the institutions in Namibia. And we've been approached by the colleagues to continue doing this. Moreover, this happens in the context of another agreement that we have with the Namibian Qualifications Authority and the Namibian Quality Agency, which actually implies exchange of personnel and the support in each other's activities. Every year, we work in the audits that take place on that year, and we start planning for the audits that take place in the following year. So we took notification visits, which basically means that myself as executive director of the APQC and the director of audits went to each of these institutions, met with the vice chancellor, and the senior management team and explain what work that we were going to do, etc. Of these notification visits, we did one at Tshwane University of Technology, the University of Pretoria, the Durban University of Technology, the University of the Western Cape, and one private provider, the Independent Institute of Education. All of these audits took place during 2006. We have produced 5 reports, and we are doing ongoing research on the impact that our audits are having. So we have commissioned a team of researchers to basically follow the rhythm of the audit. They come to the institution before the audit during the preparation time. They come to the institution immediately after the audit. And then they come to the institution after they have received the audit report. So we have a sense of what it is that the institutions are doing, how are they reacting to the work of the GQC, and whether what we do have the impact that we are expecting it to have. When the GQC was constituted in 2001, the board of the HQC added to the legislative function of promoting quality assurance the function of developing quality, developing capacity for quality. And this had to do with the issues of legacy in the country. And therefore we constituted a directorate called Quality Promotion and Capacity Development that has a fundamental function in, on the one hand, supporting the work of the TQC, because thanks to that directorate, we have trained evaluators and trained auditors who can help with our system. But also, this has an impact inside the higher education institution, because basically, if you develop greater capacity to develop programs, for example, for design of curriculum or for monitoring or for assessing in general, you are actually increasing the capacity of institutions for themselves. So what we have done during the year has been training of evaluators, both for our program accreditation directorate and for our national reviews directorate. We have done training of auditors and audit chairs. And also in the area of promotion, quality, and one might say also capacity development, we hold what we call quality forums. These quality forums are held both with private providers and with public providers, and basically are gatherings of the individuals who are responsible at each institution, usually for the quality portfolio, but we are trying to enlarge it to get together planners and people who are responsible for teaching and learning at the highest possible level. In the case of the public providers, we hold these forums in collaboration with HISA. And we have held so far 3 with them, and have been an interesting experience. Also in the area of promotion, we have developed a project called Student Quality Literacy, which is focused on 2 sets of issues. On the one hand, it focuses on prospective students for higher education. We were very concerned at the fact that students do not know how to judge the quality of the programs they are trying to enroll in or the institutions they are going to. And this was particularly serious when we had many more private providers than we have now and the environment was not sufficiently regulated. But this is also important for students who go into public higher education. So that's the one focus of the program. The other focus of the project is on the students who are currently at higher education institutions. And the idea is try and work with the SRCs, with the teams of the students, with the institutions, and the students themselves, in order to make them aware of what does quality mean and what are their responsibilities and their rights in relation to the quality of provision that it is offered to them. And then the other major project that we have been involved in is part of a national project, which is a South African-Finland collaboration. And the ACTC has been responsible for the focus on quality of that particular program. Basically, the program has had two main focus. On the one hand, it has been working with helping merge and historically disadvantaged institutions to focus on the quality systems, the internal quality systems. And these have been specific in the area of design and systems, but also has had to do with dealing with issues such as harmonization of curriculum in the case of merged institutions, dealing with pipeline students when in the case of merged institutions that had to discontinue programs and all that. But also, this program had another leg that was there to reward innovation in developing quality for programs. And that was open to all institutions that didn't fall in either of the other two categories. Professor Mayatula, I would like my colleague Theo Bengu to refer to the area of the national reviews, which is the area in which he has been particularly involved.
Thanks, Dr.
Lange.
Chair, you members might actually recall that about 3 years ago, we came here and addressed the committee before we embarked on the current national review that we've been busy with, which is the national review of professional and academic programs in education. Dr. Lange has alluded to the fact that the national reviews are a particular form of accreditation within the HEQC, which focuses on the reaccreditation of already existing programs. Because when the HEQC was constituted way back in 2001, there were thousands and thousands of programs that already existed in the system. And so the HEQC board took a decision that, before an institution offers a new program, they needed to submit that for accreditation. But in relation to the existing programs, the HEQC then designed a system which was known as the System of National Reviews. And that would mean that the board would actually choose a particular discipline or area which strategically is very, very important for the higher education sector. And all institutions that offer programs within that particular area would actually need to submit make submissions for accreditation of those programs. You'll remember that the first national review that we did in the 2003-2004 period was the review of MBA programs. That review then was then followed, just to come to this national review now, with the review, as I was saying, of professional and academic programs in education. And the whole range of reasons were actually given for this national review, two of which I'd just like to quickly refer to. If you go back to the National Plan for Higher Education, one of the issues that is raised there is that raised by the department is that the HEQC would need to look at the quality of postgraduate programs in South Africa, because the ability of the country to produce the next cadre of researchers would actually depend upon the quality of those programs. And secondly, this review, because it also involves professional teacher education programs, we believe that it is a review that will, in the long run, improve the quality of school education. Because if we've got quality teacher education programs, then there's the potential to then produce quality teachers, and that would then mean that there's an improvement in the entire school system. So that is, the sort of background to this national review that we've been doing. Chair, in this period that you're talking about, the 2006 and 2007 period, the ACTC evaluated the whole range of programs as far as teacher education is concerned. We evaluated the advanced certificate in education, that is 8 programs in that particular case. We evaluated 9 postgraduate certificate in education programs. We also evaluated 5 VED programs. And that involved 10 higher education institutions and 22 programs in total. And this was a very intensive process. I mean, each panel that went to each institution for a site visit consisted of not less than 9 people. So it was a very, very intensive process of, you know, informed by, in which the academics that are involved in teacher education very, very actively participated. We also, during this period, looked at both the review of the MEd programs. We did that in the year preceding the period that we're reporting on, which is 2005. So the ITTC was also busy monitoring all the programs that were given conditional accreditation in 2005 to monitor, to check whether the institutions were taking those conditions seriously, were addressing them, and to what extent those conditions were actually addressed, so that if they were addressed, then those programs could then move to the next step of being awarded full accreditation by the ATTC board. Of course, during the MEd review, there were programs that were not successful, whose accreditation was withdrawn. Also, that needed a lot of monitoring, a lot of work with the institutions, which was done by the ATTC in terms of, you know, requesting institutions to submit their teach-out plans, how are they going to phase out the program. So what the program is no longer accredited, the institution can no longer accept new students onto the program, and so they need to phase out the currently existing students that were involved in that particular program. So that also was part of the work in as far as the national reviews were concerned. We also, during this period, prepared the panel. You know, the calendar refers to the fact that the Quality Promotion and Capacity Development Directorate trains evaluators for program accreditation and for national review. So that work was done in collaboration with Quality Promotion and Capacity Development to prepare panels for the site visits that were going to take place now this year in 2007. About, you know, more than 40 programs have now been evaluated this year. We did the national review in such a way that we actually staged the review. You know, all those institutions that are not affected by the measures and so on were done in the first cycle, which was in 2006, and those that were affected by measures and all other complexities then were evaluated in 2007. Just to go back to the fact that when we, in 2005, evaluated the MEd program, it was really focusing not on the MEd as a qualification, but on a specific specialization of the MEd, which is the MEd in management and leadership. Of course, if an institution was not offering this, we had to actually select another, a different MEd specialization. But, you know, and also in relation to the B.Ed, we actually focused on the B.Ed foundation and intermediate phase. In the A's program, we looked at the A's in mathematics or science, or a combination of those, in terms of how they are arranged at institutions. And with the PGCE, we looked at the S.E.T. Phase. The reason for that, I mean, is actually twofold. On the one hand, it is to actually look at the signal. The fact that there needs to be quality, you know, teacher education at all institutions of higher learning so that we then improve the quality of our schooling system in the country. But also to respond to the need, we have to do this within the context of the fact that there is a supply and demand question in as far as teachers are concerned in South Africa. We actually need more teachers. So we need to actually do this in a way that would signal, you know, the fact that there needs to be quality teacher education, but also not to actually close down if it came to an adverse, you know, kind of a decision in relation to any program, so that you don't actually close down the whole MEd, or the whole A, all the ACEs that exist in an institution, or all the PN programs, or all the PGCE programs, but you just close that particular specific program if there are problems around that, such as the institution can still continue with the other programs, but learning from the experience, you know, from the report of the program that was specifically under review in this particular case. So this has been, you know, a very, very sensitive review, because, you know, on the one hand, as I was saying, you know, we actually need more teachers, but we actually need quality teachers. And so you need to signal issues of quality, but at the same time respond to the supply and demand issue in as far as teacher education is concerned. So for this particular reason, in other normal circumstances, you might recall, when we did national reviews, there were only three categories of decisions that could be taken by the ATTC board in relation to each program evaluated. the program could either get full accreditation, which means that, you know, the program is generally, it actually meets the criteria and the minimum standards for quality in relation to that program. Or it could be accredited with conditions, which means that, you know, the program is fine, but there are certain conditions which the institutions needed to actually work on while continuing with the program. Or the problem is the program, there were serious problems and compromises on quality, then the program would actually not be accredited. So those were the three categories in the first national review, the first two reviews that we did, the MBA one as well as the MEd review. But now with the teacher education programs, the professional programs in education, we have to introduce a fourth kind of a decision that could actually be taken in relation to the programs, which is that bullet which says on notice of withdrawal. This is in cases where you may find that the program, there are huge problems in relation to the quality of the program. But the educative board might actually consider the region where the institution, for instance, is one of the factors, where the institution is located. And if that program is just summarily closed down, then that would affect that particular province or that particular region very, very badly in terms of the production of teachers or the educators for the country. So the board then introduced this decision of saying that you are accredited with conditions, but should you not be able to address these conditions within the next 90 days, or demonstrate that you can address them within the next 90 days, then the program could actually be withdrawn. You know, the accreditation of that program would actually be withdrawn. So it is in a sense something between the accreditation with conditions, something much more serious than that, but not as serious as to just simply, you know, say that the program is actually no longer accredited, it's just simply withdrawn. So this has happened in a few institutions where, you know, the education board took this particular decision and the institution has been, you know, has actually been informed that they need to demonstrate to them that period that they can address those conditions and then with some kind of assistance, you know, and the institution's own initiative to actually address those kinds of problems. So, yeah, this is what the work on the National Review's site has actually involved, you know, with this whole area of teacher education and the quality of such programs.
Chair, very briefly, some organizational information for the members to know where we are at in relation to that. This is the profile of vacancies at March 2007. You know that we are in search for a CEO. You might have seen the advertisements in the newspapers. That's the only sort of senior management, executive level post that we are not filling, and we are advertising for a director of monitoring. At the middle management, we are, as we last year we had less people than we needed, but in general, we are quite close to a full staff complement. In terms of equity profile, we are quite happy that our organization is has a very nice representation of the population of the country. In the gender profile, actually, we are doing fantastically well because the organization is almost run by women. In terms of finances, as you can see, our appropriation of government funds have increased compared to 2006 and 2007, and our dependence on donor funding has decreased, which for us is important at more than one level. This graph about income and expenditure is something that makes us quite proud, because those of you who have heard our presentation since 1999 probably asked us several times why we were so unable to spend our money. And what this graph shows is, on the one hand, the state allocation to the CHE has increased over the years, but also the CHE capacity to spend its allocation has increased. Simultaneously, and I think that as the CHE proved itself in its work, is necessary dependence on donor funding diminished, and now we are sort of fully funded by the state. We still have very good relationship with donors, but the bulk of our funding, all our core activities are funded by government. This is it, Professor Mayatula, and we're happy to answer any questions, technical or otherwise.
Thank you so much. We allow my members to come up with their comments or questions. Another one, yeah.
Chairperson, I just want to inquire, first of all, is this an annual report we're dealing with, and if it is, are there no audit reports that they are for us to look at?
Yeah.
There are, this is the annual report that you're dealing with, and our audited financial statement is in the annual report that was sent to Parliament. I mean, yeah. Happy to answer any questions that you might have, but I mean, the annual report was sent to Parliament. The briefing doesn't include the financial statement. The financial statement is in the actual report.
And the point now?
Thank you, Chairperson. Talking of quality of higher education and higher education graduates, I know that there is a direct linkage between quality of high school graduates with quality of higher education graduates. Now, my problem here is there is a culture of non-commitment to work at high school level. As a result, learners who are set not, rather the system is such that learners cannot repeat a class twice, so that if a learner fails the same class twice, is promoted to the next class, and this goes on and on until he gets to matric. Now, I want to find out from you as to whether if learners who go to the university with such sloppy marks really go through the university education, can you guarantee that the university can be in a position to produce quality graduates if there's no quality at high school level that is produced? Because 35% a learner grads, then he gets bonus marks in order to be promoted to the next class. Thank you.
Thank you,
maybe let's correct that one. You fail once in a phase. Remember, you have phases at high school. I'm trying to correct that so that I don't say in a class you fail once. In a given phase.
In a phase.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another from Mashama.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to check on this the accreditation with condition, the impact on that process, whether there is any improvement on that conditional accreditation. And the other one on institutional audit. I'm from Limpopo. If I can just get maybe an answer why Limpopo, University of Limpopo, is not amongst the selected universities. And then on the comment on women, I just want to get a comment also on the people with disability, their percentage there. Thank you, Chair.
Hello,
thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I would like to ask on the issue of institutional audit. Obviously, you do make recommendations as the HEQC. I just want to know as to whether who actually ensures that the recommendations that are made are implemented, And I also like to know as whether these are enforceable or not, because I'm sure you like to make recommendations that will make a difference. So I just want to know as whether we just continue to make recommendations which are not enforceable. If they are, who does that, and how is that impacting on the running of this institution? Secondly, Chairperson, on the student quality literacy project, you said this is done both for prospective students of higher education institutions as well as those who are already in the institutions themselves. I think it's quite clear how you do that for those who are already in the institutions. But I would like to know as to, in the case of the prospective students, when and how is this a project conducted, and what is the impact thereof? And then with regards to the harmonization of curriculum, especially with the merged universities, I just want to know also what progress has been made in that regard. Can I safely say, for instance, in the case of the Northwest University, that a student who registers at the Mafikeng campus for a program similar to the student who registers at the Potchefstroom campus, is the curriculum, where will they get the same tuition in terms of material and in terms of teaching? And Chairperson, on the national reviews that were conducted, we note that in 2005 there were those institutions who were given a conditional accreditation for certain programs. Now, I just want to know as to now, during the review, those institutions that were given conditional accreditation, did they finally get their accreditation? And in those cases where they have not, what are the major reasons for that? Is there something that can be done to ensure that those institutions are able to offer those programs? And finally, Chairperson, on the national reviews, we are all aware that there is a shortage of math and science teachers. But when I look at the national reviews that we've done with the aim of improving the quality of teachers, I see at the MS level, we're looking at management and leadership programs. For the PS, we are looking at foundation and intermediate. Only at the A's level were we looking at mathematics. I just want to know as to how will this assist, these reviews, how will they assist in ensuring that we get quality, good quality teachers, and specifically in math and science? Thanks, Chairperson.
Honorable Chamber.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, just to add one dimension, which was asked around accreditation conditionally. My observation here is that most of the institutions which received, conditional accreditation are from the so-called historically disadvantaged universities. Although not all of them, but the majority of them. Now, you have said that now some of the institutions may be given, conditionally, which is influenced by a possible adverse effect that may happen because of its geographical location. Now, does this suggest that now, this is more discretionary, so to speak. The institution, the quality of the provision of education is so low, but then you can make some provision, because it may have some possible effects, which means now the criteria is no longer the quality, but possible effects. But this should be linked with the whole issue of institutional redress, which is provided in the policy framework. To what extent does the council, engage itself, in this question of of institutional redress in terms of these challenges. Because if now you leave an institution and say now you must improve, knowing its history and the provision of redress, now how to reconcile this issue? And at the same time, what is the role of quality promotion and capacity building directories with respect to assessing those institutions in Abuja so that now they are able to pick up the standard? And then lastly, the project on institutional autonomy and academic freedom. I get a sense that now the due date has been, you know, updated time and again. Because I thought we were going to have a report sometime this year, but similarly it has been shifted. Can there be some clarity?
Yeah, thank you, Prof. Let me ask a question around the whole area of transformation of institutions of higher learning. We still have at this point some institutions that are wrestling with transformation. I want to know what role you as a council play in matters of transformation in our institutions. A case in point here is the university, where we still have instances where there are problems around integration of hostels. I need your comment in as far as this is concerned. And I would also wish to actually get a sense of what the concerns mostly are of your vice chancellors, I'm sorry, when you meet with them as South African University Vice Chancellors Association. I do believe that they have common concerns. But what are mostly those concerns that they articulate when they meet with you? Lastly, I would want to get a sense as to your take on the selection criteria, applied by different institutions in terms of student admission. Do you have a comment on the fact that there are different standards applied in different institutions? What can you report about that, if you will?
Are you through, Madam?
I am through for now.
Over to you, Stacey. I sense you're not sure. I saw your light was on.
Yeah, no, there's something
there. Now, see, you can respond.
We might be here a bit longer than we expected. The quality of the school leavers and the quality of the graduates. I mean, this is not an intractable problem, but this is one of the most complicated problems that higher education is facing and the country as a country is facing. If we could guarantee that if for every enrollment we have a graduate, we wouldn't have the dropout rate and the throughput rates that we have in the country. Not all the problems have to do with the quality of education that pupils have at high school level, but a lot has to do with it. Universities are, in different ways, each of them, doing a number of things in order to address this thing. Government has also put the possibility of funding for foundation programs. We are trying to address some of the shortcomings of skills and cognitive issues the students come with. So different students are doing different things. This is a very, very complicated matter. Even if higher education accepts that we will do, in a manner of speaking, what the school system cannot do, in order to do that, there are a number of things that are necessary. Amongst them is certainly much greater funding for these issues. This is about teaching the teachers. Don't forget that higher education teachers are not necessarily teachers themselves. They know the discipline, but they are not necessarily good teachers. There are issues about language. There are a number of issues that bedevil these problems. So, although I understand the impatience that we all have, how many enrollments have you got and how many good graduates can you produce, the problem is very complex, and it's one of those issues of legacy that all of you have been referring in one question or another. Why Limpopo is not in the list of audits? Because Limpopo will be audited in 2010. The audit cycle started in 2004 and goes until 2010. We do accredit around 300 programs a year. We do national reviews of around 20 programs a year, and we audit about 5 universities a year. We can't do more than that. Each audit takes a huge amount of time. And we started off with institutions that were not touched by the mergers in order to give those that were touched by the mergers more time. So the Vice Chancellor of the University of Limpopo was invited to attend a meeting about his audit at the CHE yesterday, as a matter of fact. We do not have employees with disabilities at the CHE, I'm afraid. We haven't had any applicants with disabilities, so we haven't been tested in that sense. We have an equity policy, so I mean, should we have applications from people with disability, we will have to see how our policies work in that regard. Whether the recommendations of audits are enforceable? Yes and no. They are not enforceable in the sense that audits do not have consequences in the same way that accreditation have consequences. You cannot de-accredit an institution. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we try to make audits into a dialogue, in a sense, between the higher education committee and the institution. Institutions receive their reports, and against those reports, they need to produce an improvement plan. That improvement plan is scrutinized by a committee constituted by the HQC that tries to assess whether the institution has actually responded to the concerns that the audit report puts, and whether the mechanisms that are put in place in order to respond to those concerns are going to actually do the job. And after a while, we actually come back to the institution and talk to them about how well have they done in relation to those improvement plans. We are thinking that probably the second cycle of audits that comes out from 2011 will be most probably focused on whether institutions have managed to actually make all the improvements that they promised to do in the first cycle. I'm just trying to deal with all the questions that were on this area. Project. The autonomy, yes, there was an update in terms of the production of the report of the investigation on autonomy. And this has to do with the fact that the conceptual investigation, the definitions and the implications of the conceptualizations of governance took much longer than we imagined. And then we still needed to do some empirical research in order to understand whether fundamentally the same mechanisms that government has chosen, funding, planning, and quality assurance, were regarded by higher education institutions as actually infringing institutional autonomy and academic freedom. What do we do in relation to transformation? I think that there must be very few words in the vocabulary of South Africa which are so used as transformation, of which so many people have so many different interpretations. While transformation at some institution might seem on the surface to only have to do with issues of equity, transformation at all institutions has to do with much deeper issues than those. Changing the way in which one teaches, changing the institutional culture. All of those issues are things that are being grappled with at all institutions. And at other institutions, transformation might mean to actually challenge the place that institution has had in the higher education system in the old dispensation. So it's a host of things. In the particular case that the member of the committee is referring to, the institution was audited. The report made a very strong recommendation, and the institution is acting on it. But sometimes things are more complicated than one imagines. Institutions do not function isolated from the environment. Institutions are not just the students and the academic staff or the general staff. Institutions are also the parents of the students. And different generations have different things. So sometimes one thinks that when one takes one student to university, you need to take a whole family for process of re-education, in a sense. But we are watching over those things because we think that those things have an impact in the quality of the educational experience that the students have. So we regard those issues as part of our brief. I cannot really tell you what the concerns of the vice chancellors are because that I think that you should talk to HISA for that. But every time that we have met the vice chancellor lately, they have talked about more money. But I think that this is a permanent problem with vice chancellors. What are the selections that we apply for the different institutions? All institutions have to apply the same bottom line. All the students that come into higher education as candidates have to have a matric exemption. This applies differently. Some institutions, for reasons of equity and access, are prepared to do a special admission system, either by discretion of Senate or RPL, or it depends on the cases. If different institutions didn't have different admission criteria, it would be very difficult for all the students that are currently in higher education to be in higher education. The issue is not so much what are the different admission requirements, but what are the systems of support that institutions have once the students are in. Getting in is relatively easy. Getting through is fundamentally the problem here. I think that I have answered all the questions that were on my plate.
Chair, if I could answer the second half of the question. The first question that Jim was about, you know, the accreditation with conditions, is there any real improvement in that kind of thing? Institutions are aware that if they don't address the conditions that are attached to the programs during the national review in relation to accreditation with conditions, they do so to their peril or to the peril of the program. So for that reason, institutions have taken those conditions very, very seriously. Right from the MBA review that we did the first time around, there were all the programs that were accredited with conditions are actually, as I'm speaking today, now fully accredited programs. Even in relation to the MEd program, all programs, I mean, well, of course, we were just reporting for this particular financial year, but subsequent to the end of the financial year, all the MEd programs that were, you know, that were granted accreditation with conditions, except two, have now met the conditions for accreditation, for full accreditation. So, you know, all of them have been fully accredited except the two. In relation to the two, there were understandable reasons why not. You know, there were some complexities around the merger and a whole range of issues. And for that reason, the ATPC board has extended for another few months, for about 6 months, you know, the period during which those institutions have to address those conditions. But the institutions are actually taking that whole exercise very, very seriously, because should they fail to address the condition, it means that, you know, the program would actually not be accredited when it's officially reviewed. The second question has to do with the student quality literacy project and how it, you know, how it covers students before they enter higher education. I mean, very, very simply, you know, what we have actually done in this regard, we have, you know, spoken to a number of newspapers. I mean, we've done this project actually even before it was formalized as a student quality literacy, while it was in the accreditation directorate. We have, from 2002, been doing a whole range of supplements in newspapers. You know, we talked to, the newspaper which was under the Mail and Guardian, known as The Teacher, which usually goes to each and every school in the country. So we produce supplements there. You know, how do you see whether this is a legitimate or not a legitimate institution, what are your rights and that kind of thing. So we actually have produced those kinds of supplements, especially targeting the matric students. We have also, you know, you might actually have seen this in some of the independent newspapers, you know, that group, in the Cape Agassiz, in the Cape, in the Daily News in Devon, the Natal Mercury, Solaz, and a whole range of other newspapers have produced similar supplements, have produced editorials to try and actually make students aware what are their rights. So we've talked to various radio stations in the past few years, and especially the radio stations which use indigenous South African languages, to make students aware of all this kind of, and we actually do these things usually, you know, at certain points in the year when students are likely to make up their minds, you know, as to which institution to go to. So we very do that quite strategically. Usually, you know, in the January February period, just as the students have gotten their matric results and they want to decide to, you know, which institution they want to go to, and also in the July period, because some institutions, you know, have two registration points in the year, you know, at the beginning and as well as in the middle. Chair, there was a question about the harmonization of programs in merged institutions that I just want to address. You know, the progress in this regard has been seen both from the perspective of, you know, of accreditation, program accreditation, from the perspective of national reviews, and especially from the perspective of the project that Dr. Lange was referring to, which is the South Africa-Finland cooperation project, where, you know, which is actually assisting institutions that have merged to actually, you know, consolidate their quality management system, which actually involves the alignment of programs. You know, I cannot, you know, actually claim that all institutions have done, you know, progress in the same way. There are institutions which, you know, which are facing some difficulties here and there, and they've actually communicated that. But quite a number of institutions have now harmonized their programs and are dealing with the process in as far as that is concerned. The issue of math and science teachers, why we looked at management. You think, let me just, why we looked at management and leadership in the MEds, and only in the ACES did we look at math and science education. Yeah, there were quite a number of things that needed to be considered by the ATPC. Over and above the question of the supply and demand of teachers, especially the math and science teachers in particular, the ATPC also had to look at the capacity of the organization itself and of the institutions, you know, to actually deal with this national review. And that is why, you know, the selection was, I mean, as has been presented to you. With regard to MH management and leadership, I mean, we all know that, you know, there is a proliferation of MH management and leadership in the company. you know, and some of things which are ridiculous, as you find that at the management and leadership focusing on principals, for HODs, that kind of thing, and you see that kind of proliferation. So the understanding of quality of that was very, very important. But let me just say this. The fact that we did not focus, say, on the BS in science, does not, if during the review of the BS, of whatever BS was selected for that institution, the HTC found that there were such serious compromises on quality on that particular BS, the HTC reserves the right to say that we'll actually come back and review all your BS programs. The same thing with AIDS programs, the same thing with MS programs, and so on and so forth. So they basically communicated very, very clearly to the institutions that we will actually do that kind of an exercise. Okay, there was a question here about the that notice of withdrawal and whether it's based on quality or other considerations as well. Yeah, as far as that is concerned, the issue it's a decision that is still based on quality, let me say. But some of the what I was saying earlier, some of the conditions are quite serious. That you find that program is actually a borderline kind of a program, and of course you have to actually factor in other considerations as well. But it's not to say that the you're actually now relegating the responsibility, abdicating the responsibility of looking at quality. You are actually still looking at quality. In fact, there are programs even within the professional teacher education programs where the HTC just said it just can't be accredited at all. So the considerations that are there are very, very important as well. I think that's it. Thank you, sir.
My time also agrees. Shall we cross over to not one? I have 20 questions. I'm not going to answer. I'm crossing over. If we have time at the end, we can come back. Now to the group. Can write it down. I'm sorry, I have to do that. Fortunately, I said that I would even before I started. I don't want to ban. Just put that question down that you must ask. Just put your question down. Yeah, true. I'm sure you can answer that Demosala's question while you are setting up. Yes.
I was just going to ask whether your audit report on individual institutions can be available on request.
The audit reports are available on summary basis from the CDHC website.
Complete one?
No. The
confidential.
They are confidential. That's what guarantees that institutions tell us everything. And that's part of the process. But if not, everybody could be usable. So we produce the executive summary, which is very, very comprehensive. And that's available from the CDHC.
And he does have a laptop. I'm sure he can press it enough. It's better than nothing. Let's check the summary and see.
extra money.
I'm told we are also going to be having invited all of us for a sit-down lunch just across here, right here where we are, when we are through with our meetings. Everybody is invited.
Yes, I thought we were still working. Already.
I'm ready where you are.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and honorable members of this committee. We appreciate the opportunity to exchange views about the progress and the work of NISPAS, but at the outset, I would ask Mel Festus, the acting CEO, to briefly introduce the people that are here with me.
Good morning, Professor Mayatula and members of the committee and other colleagues. The NISPAS representatives, we are pleased to say that everyone has heard Sipho Batiana, the chairperson of the NISPAS board. I'm also pleased to introduce Nasima Bachar, a member, and I'm sure many people are familiar with Sipho and Nasima is with us today. I have my colleague Julian Topkin, he's our IT manager and forms part of the senior management team. At the end there, Polanic could wave to us. Polanic, our communications officer. Linda has just left the room. She's our chief operations officer. And then myself, as she both indicated, I am the chief financial officer and currently also the acting CEO. And also, thank you for giving us this opportunity. And I will now hand over to Sipho to present our work to you.
Thank you very much, Mel. I guess everybody has a copy of the revised PowerPoint presentation. Well, as you know, NISPAS was established in 1999 by the Minister of Education in terms of the legislation of Parliament to provide the granting of loans and bursaries to eligible students at higher educational institutions and for the administration of such loans and bursaries and recoveries of money therefrom. The purpose of NISPAS is to provide access to higher education to deal with the challenges of lack of access to those who are coming from previously disadvantaged backgrounds in support of the country's high human resources development strategy, while at the same time alleviating poverty and to raise sufficient resources to realize the strategic objectives, to regularly review the formula of allocation of funding to higher education within higher education system that is constantly under transformation. So we've pursued those objectives. In addition to that, the students generally in the higher education sector have taken a very favorable view of what NISPAS has had to deliver. And I've included the brief commentary on what some of the students have had to say. You'll see that the comments rank in two parts. One is a student who is relieved having finished the repayment of the loan, but committing that it's important that the students that follow should benefit. And the other that expresses appreciation for the support and the difference that this organization and this intervention by government through NISPAS has made in his life. I thought those were interesting quotes. I won't go through them. If you look at the number of awards, the scheme has grown over a period of time. In terms of the rand value of the awards from 1991, and that traces the scheme back to its predecessor, in 1999, when we started at 75 million, the award granted to 75,000.
Unfortunately, my copy is in sabotage. It does not have years, does not have figures.
Oh, I see.
No.
Well, Julian is a technologist, so he'll tell you what happened there. we'll settle for what you see. Oh, the next page. Is it clear in the next page? Okay. But better still is the color copy on the, if that helps. That's the number of awards. In fact, by 2007, NISFAS was assisting 25% of the higher education student population. And that's a very significant number and tells a story about the growth of the scheme. And I think it's important to make the point there that that's the bottom end of the deserving category of students. I'll raise an issue later about the category that doesn't qualify, that's deserving, which is a challenge that we have to deal with. The next slide gives an indication of the profile of the racial background, a breakdown of the allocation where the monies go to. As you know, the allocation formula is determined, is predicated on a mean test that is poverty indexed. And that breakdown there reflects that. The awards total in rand terms clearly indicate government commitment to growing the scheme as the demand for higher education from the poor increases every year. And you will know, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee, that that growth, notwithstanding the demand for assistance, continues to grow. In 2007, the expenditure of NISFAS stands at about 1.8 billion rand. That figure there of just about 1.4 goes up to 2006.
Maybe it would be important that we send that page, that chart, that slide. When we refer to the next page, we refer to this one. The first one does not have the figure.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. The operating costs have been kept at a very minimum. And I must say this compares favorably to other institutions in terms of recipients of huge grants. This is the cost as a portion of the expenditure of NISFAS is kept at a very low level. The average of awards have increased as well. As you know, the cost of higher education has escalated phenomenally over a period of time. The average in 2006 stood at about 11,000, and the minimum at about 2,000. It's encouraging to see how the good performance of students that refers to courses passed, and I would like to make the distinction immediately that doesn't suggest throughput rates, because the courses pass, sometimes students pass courses but don't complete degrees for a whole range of reasons which may have nothing to do with the with issues around funding, maybe other considerations. It's important that in this financial year we took on additional responsibilities as NISFAS, which suggests strong confidence in the way the scheme is run and the administration of the scheme. And also we encourage that we were asked to do that because it enables us to create partnerships with focused areas of intervention. The Funza Lushaka scheme for teachers over that 3-year period of time from this year to 2009, that's the breakdown. Funding of FET college students programs and the social work programs. And I must say we got that funding on some of those was in the commitment to MISFAS administering those was advised very late in the year last year. And so don't be surprised if you hear about some teething problems around the administration of those programs. But we are committed to assisting to making sure that those run as smoothly as the other programs do. As you know, there are 50 FET colleges in 9 provinces, and there are about 100 million rand available for these in 2007, of which 66 million has been allocated to FETs to assist 12,000 students on an average of just about 5,500 rand per salary. And we thought it's important to highlight the kind of programs that those students will be going through, and a lot of them relate to a number of areas that are linked to SCAR skills programs. I didn't comment in this about the shift in the funding breakdown of NISFAS increasingly towards the SCAR skills areas in line with the human resources development strategies. I've given an indication about the minimum awards. You will see there that the maximum cost of funding as determined by NISFAS in terms of its own assessment of what's happening in higher education is about 35,000. So at the top end in 2007, that's what a student who fully deserves the full award would get, but the minimum has been kept at that rate. And at a rate of interest of 7%. You will note that that rate of 7% is 3 basis points below prime, below repo. So, and about 6 basis points below prime. So it's a rate of interest on money that you will not find anywhere in the marketplace. A very important component of the NISFAS functioning is recoveries. NISFAS has been very successful in administering recoveries. As you can see, the in line with the growth of the allocation of funding to various students, the recoveries have also consistently shown a steady rise, and those recoveries are very important part of the funding of the income of NISFAS. To give an indication of the monthly average and the continued improvement, you see from 2004 February and August what on a monthly basis how that scheme has been improving, registering 36 million per month in the month of August. And I must say this was a very sore point with students when we have our stakeholder interactions. This is one aspect that students don't like to hear about. But we have engaged, and I think there's a common understanding that's a very important element of the scheme and its sustainability. The next graph basically shows the place of the recovered funds to the income of NISFAS. The purple blocks there at the bottom give an indication of that. We'll break that down later on. It's detailed a little bit better in the next slide. where we indicate that from 14.2 1999 to 341 million rand in 2007 is money reinjected into the scheme from recoveries. Now, most of you would know how this scheme works. We allocate funding to institutions which administer the scheme through the financial aid bureaus. Allocation formula is informed by the number of students and the cost of study at the respective institution. So a student at a low fee institution may not get the full grant, and the student at a high fee institution may not get a full grant, but the indication, the allocation would be determined by the cost of study at that particular institution. Financial aid offices then invite applications. NISFAS runs a means test to assess potential applications. And then the determination of the size of the award is then finalized. The financial aid offices ensure that the loan agreement forms are completed by the recipients and that this is done correctly. NISFAS processes the claims and makes payments through financial aid offices. Now, the financial aid offices are a very important component of the work of NISFAS, and we have structured programs to do audits of the financial aid bureaus to see how they work. We've introduced an award system to incentivize them to ensure that they are encouraged, and also to promote standards in terms of quality assurance, etc. And this is the work that the Linda Sumaya here, who was out when she was introduced, is responsible for. As a chief operations officer, she is, among other things, one of her roles is to oversee the work of the financial aid bureaus, so they fall under. That graph there briefly indicates the parameters in respect of the allocation, the minimum allocation, the interest rate, and the maximum allocation. Now, some areas of focus going forward would include dealing with some of the challenges that I was alluding to. One of the first challenges that I commented very briefly on is that we, as a country, are missing out on a category of needy students, and these are children of entry-level middle-class families who don't qualify in terms of NISFAS because they are deemed in terms of the earnings of their parents to be coming from families that should afford higher education. The problem is that in most cases, they would have to go to banks to secure loans to fund their higher education. And if their parents' creditworthiness does not meet the bank's standards, they would not qualify for loans. So they don't qualify for bank loans, and they don't qualify for NISFAS loans. So they're in a twilight zone. And so the country is losing out on those students or potential students. So you could very well have in that category people who have the potential, but the system loses out on them because they don't have income. And this is something that has seized a great deal of the board's time as to how do we deal with this particular issue, because the banks take a view on the parents and discriminate against the students. So one of the things that we're looking at in the private public partnership is to look at developing funds that will we use to underwrite the loans that the students then access from the banks. And we've been in conversations with the banks to look at how we can do this. And we've had discussions with Treasury, which is favorably disposed to supporting this kind of initiative. Now, to establish that fund, we're going to need to have sustained fundraising efforts and get the private sector to make significant donations to through NISFAS. The private sector is contributing to higher education through uncoordinated interventions. We think that there is a great deal of benefit that will be derived from a coordinated effort. We're not suggesting that they should channel their funding only through NISFAS, but we think that there is a great deal to be gained in doing this, and we've been in conversation with the private sector in that regard. And we'll be appointing an executive responsible for development, specifically to tap the favorable response, initial response that we've received from the private sector in that regard. The second aspect is that we think we need to do a lot more detailed research than the organization has the capacity to do around the changing trends in higher education and issues around student life and how these impact on the performance of students and what that means for NISFAS and its responsibilities.
You're not talking to that class.
No, I'm just raising the issues that elaborating on some of the points that that we're going to be dealing with. So the issue around communication with institutions and vice chancellors. We have worked hard on. We've had meetings with ESA. We've had meetings with various institutions, particularly around the functioning of the higher education of the financial aid bureaus, but also issues around these challenges that we're talking about this category of students that is not catered for, because some of the institutions are funding, some of the private sector donors are funding. Bursary is directed at institutions. Maybe there's a room there for us to collaborate. I think that covers all the issues. I'm quite happy that my colleagues did say so to that. Otherwise, I'll suggest that we take questions.
I'll open for my member. I think that's a point.
Thank you, Professor. Many of the students coming from indigenous families encounter serious problems when they get to the universities wanting to register. The universities want cash in hand for them to register, and in that way, they cannot be able to access NSFAS, because I think the condition is that you can get the money if you are a registered student at a particular university. How do you help in that school?
I thought that was because it got in 1995. We don't have that. Yeah. Honorable Pandeyeva.
Chairperson, one is particularly pleased when one looks at the audit report that, you know, there's a very good audit report in terms of the management of the finances of NSFAS that's been declared. You know, the audit report mentions about better verification of data and time savings within the processes of capturing, processing, and scanning of the loan agreements, the NSFAS loan agreements. And then it also indicates that the audit committee is pleased that due to ongoing annual audits of the 23 higher education institutions, there has been a significant improvement in compliance for the NSFAS requirements at these institutions. I think the slide with regard to the recoveries on loans is also indicative of the dedication of our colleagues in this difficult matter of recovering loans. One would hope that, you know, that the time management that is obviously characterized finances and audits, that those time management will continue, and that whatever outstanding matters there are that still need to be attended to in terms of management and auditing, that those will be attended to as scrupulously as in the past. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Ndoli.
I'm concerned about the issue of advocacy to high schools. Well, we try, you know, in our constituencies, but with the limited resources, we simply can't get around to all these high schools and so on. Do you have that mechanism? Because every time I go to a high school, you know, they're very easy aware of my children, especially the grade 12.
No, I'm not sure. I'm just going down the line.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, my concern is regarding this student. This financial. I mean, this credit act that. The affordability of the student. I didn't get it clear whether who is going to that arrangement made to assist those students. That who is going to be held responsible for meeting that requirement of the credit act, the affordability of the student. And then the other one is on the FET colleges, that's 100 million available for 2007, and then that 66 million has been paid to FET colleges. I just want to check whether there is that monitoring mechanism ensuring that those the money paid to those FET colleges is spent. Thank you.
And Madam Mayor.
Yes, thanks, Chairperson. Contrary to what Honorable Binamo has said, we have been informed that NSFAS now does accommodate those deserving students who are unable to pay the registration fees, and they do get assistance. I just want to know as to what extent has that improved on the accessibility of students, and related to what Honorable Ntuli has said, what do we do as NSFAS to make sure that, you know, this is communicated, especially to the needy students? Thank you.
Maybe since I also have time now to throw a few questions. Let me start with the minister. Some of us don't know as we talk about these things all over. There's a minister that is done. We go around canvassing quarters of the poor, but we do not know what that literally means. So I would appreciate that. And again, I think in Ms. Sumo's death, there is that new category, which I was saying maybe you need to look at. Where a student passes, but after passing, because we don't fund them fully, when he goes out, he is owing NSFAS. NSFAS understands that they are going to pay when you work. The institution does not understand, wants you to pay now. Because you don't pay now, you don't get a certificate. Because you don't get a certificate, you don't get employed. Because you are not employed, you accumulate interest for years and years. And we have a case of a student who passed in 1999. I'm interested to the damn student. What are the practical implications? How many students fall in that category? What is it that is, because to me, it kills the whole very project. He has passed, he can't work, therefore. Maybe to add on that one of the, let me go to the new one on page 4. I was not aware of this one of the social worker. Are these three categories falling to those categories who do not have to pay back, but they work in order to? Is that social work one also just starting now, 2007? It's a new program. So thank you. On the one, the middle group, I don't know whether that middle group, it becomes a middle group on the basis of the of that mid-term. I would have thought, who decided what the mid-term is? Would it not have been easier to just say, let us leave that mid-term to accommodate that group because we have closed them off? Something allowed here. I know you, the way you are handling it is a better way in the long run. I think I sent another teacher, for example, to another school yesterday. Say, I'm a teacher, I have this kid, I would imagine that fall in that category.
Thank you.
I'll ask my colleague to respond to a lot of these questions, but, you know, we've done, for every time we do an adjustment to the allocation formula, we commission the actuaries to look at if you change the formula, how it will affect the entirety of the scheme. So, and you have to constantly do that to secure the architecture of the scheme. So the means test is linked to that. So these people who fall outside of that threshold should ideally have access to private finance. But they don't because of the debt situation of their parents. But there's a public responsibility to those students, and we have to look at how we deal with it, and that's what we're trying to deal with. But I agree with the issue of a requirement of registration fee has been dealt with. It was, in fact, one of the issues that we dealt with when we had a meeting with all the vice chancellors. That we had communicated that students who are NISFAS, who qualify for NISFAS, should not be excluded on the grounds of not having a registration fee. And we hope that that position stands, and that the vice chancellors would get the institutions to support our program. I appreciate the comment on audit because, you know, this scheme functions on the basis of autonomous institutions called the financial aid bureaus, and anything can happen there. So there's a high risk to inconsistencies in terms of adherence to policies and programs and all of that. And it says something about the scheme that the auditors are commenting so favorably about the way the systems around the checks and balances are in place and all of that. And we would like to hold it in that way, because, especially in light of the fact that we're looking to get private sector contributions, because we think this is a selling point in our search for partnership with the private sector, and it also to do with the good work that is done by the staff at NISFAS. On the issue of communication, I think we have a big challenge there.
you hit the nail on the head. I don't think that our communication efforts are worth it, either level at which they should be. I encountered the same questions from people about the scheme. Clearly, the efforts that are being put are not yielding the kind of results that we expect, because the communication sent to the schools, and that presupposes that the schools would then encourage the children to see what is there, but that doesn't actually happen at all times. But there's a good program, the partnership with NGOs. I just hope sometimes that we could grow that program quickly. But because we give some of the NGOs money to administer, you have to make sure that they are at the right, they are ready to do that. But they assist students to, some of them assist students to actually fill in application forms and make sure that they do it properly, especially in rural areas and so on and so on. Those schemes are important, but I think we need to have a much more investment around our communication program, and the board has identified this as one of the areas we have to look at. Linda and Mel could take up with other issues on the NCA and so do that.
The NCA does not necessarily affect the parents, the students. The obligation is for the students and us. In other words, when a student applies, we do not do any credit check when they apply for the NSFAS loan. And we don't even look at the fact that some of them are under administration, because the majority of our students are not working. It only applies to students who are studying at UNISA, some of which are employed and obviously would be affected by the credit aid. But in as far as the full-time student is concerned, there's nothing much really, except that we as nurses need to comply. For example, we need to make sure that the student signs the pre agreement and quotation statement. We need to ensure that they get they sign two loan agreement forms. One is a copy and one that gets sent to us for payment. So it does not really affect them that much, except for those who are already working. Thank you. On the FET colleges, we make sure that these amounts are paid into the student account. And also we follow through with them to ensure that they pay out allowances, for example, transport, books, material or coats or things that they might need for their studies. So we follow that up. And we have a close working relationship with the Department of Education in Pretoria, the project manager. Just yesterday, we submitted a report in terms of payments and some of the challenges that we're facing. So we have one or two institutions that have not submitted their claims, hence we've only paid 66 million. But that is being followed up by the department to ensure that the problems that are being experienced by the college are sorted out immediately, so that before the end of the year, we've at least exhausted these outstanding payments to FET colleges. Yeah. And what else? Okay, the means test, it looks at the family income. It also takes into account the number of members in a household, plus students who are studying at tertiary or colleges, so in other words, post-matric. But also it looks at the cost of study at a university, and if there's accommodation, book allowances, or whether the student has a bursary other than the NSFAS loan. So it takes into account the number of variables before we can then determine how much the student needs. So there's no standard amount per institution. In other words, we cannot prescribe, but it's based on all those things put together, and therefore would then suggest an amount that a student needs to pay. In order to accommodate most financially needy students, we have to run that test so that those students who, in our view, are able to contribute towards their studies, they do so not at the expense of students who are unable
you know, so we are, unfortunately, we were dealing with a situation where we have limited funding versus a huge number of students who are competing for our resources. Yeah, so we have to run, and the NISTEP assists in determining what the student should qualify for, and therefore based on that, the institution will then make an award to the student. Okay, with the issue of historic debt probe, when I spoke to the university concerned, we were informed that when we make an allocation to an institution, the financial aid committee of that institution will then sit down with the SRC to discuss how they will distribute that allocation. Now, the problem is all these internal processes affect students at the end of the year, because the SRC will insist that no student will be excluded. So the decision is to how do we then spread these limited resources across, and therefore it means compromising and not funding the student fully in terms of the requirements by the institution for that particular year. And therefore what they would do is they would fund student 80% and the student would be expected to pay 20%, and in most cases that is not the case. And so the student would owe us that 80%, but also owe the institution the 20%. And this has been going on. And the statistics that I received just this morning from Limpopo, we're talking about over 1,000 students who are owing, who are NSFAS beneficiaries, but owing the university and cannot graduate. They've completed, but they cannot graduate. And it's about 13 million that is outstanding from those students. So we need to make a decision how we then begin to assist those students to graduate, get their certificates, and then start working.
Just to add on that, Chairperson, that in the conversation that we had with the Vice Chancellors, we actually didn't raise this issue, but we raised a different issue, that if a student is a recipient of NISPA award, the university cannot hold that student back if the student owes, has outstanding fees in respect of others, because it's a waste of public resources. You can't hold that student back if you agree that NISPA may fund that student. That presupposes that you would allow the student, if they do well academically, until they complete. But it doesn't cover this aspect of the conversation, which we may have to bring into the future.
Actually, if I might just add something related to the National Credit Act. It was quite interesting that we were, in terms of the stringent regulations, we've been identified as both a reckless credit provider on the one hand, because we don't ask for sureties, but also identified as a developmental credit provider. And under that banner, our students are covered, you know, they are protected. I think what has happened, you know, when the Credit Act was obviously put together, it was for the broadest spectrum of reckless providers of credit, and we are finding now that there's room for us to start applying for exemption from certain clauses, you know, this very stringent clauses, so that will happen in the future. But so far we're okay in terms of still assisting those needy students, even within the general requirements of the Credit Act. And then just to answer your question on social development, it is the first year that we've been asked to look after those funds from National Treasury. Thank you.
If you have some time, there are more questions.
That question is in the answer from your question.
You have 2 minutes for
the
final question. No, I did answer. I did ask the question, and it was answered. In your conversation with the bank, is there hope that they may come to the party and end this?
To be fair, the momentum on that conversation was broken by the passage of the NCA, because it introduces a new dynamic to that. So we have to look at
taking an approach that completes our agreement generally on the scheme, and maybe Treasury would agree to come to the party in a way that would enable us to get exemptions for that category of loanees from banks. But there's some negotiation that has to take place. But I think it's a difficult area. On the other hand, we have a project with the an association of unit trusts, which is a sort of a savings scheme, which encourages people to save and are incentivized to save to finance their children's education at higher education level. In fact, we're going to be launching that scheme on the 12th of this month. So it's a very important step in our search for partnerships with the financial institutions. This scheme is called the Fundisa scheme, the Fundisa fund. For every saving that a parent does, there will be a contribution from us that adds to that, which will be higher than the going rate of interest. So by the time the child goes to school, they would be able to have some funds available to them. So that's one of the projects, and we'll pursue the discussion on this other fund, which is basically will be a fund to underwrite loans from banks to the students.
Babando, it's not compulsory to go to our first.
Yeah, I'm fully aware, but there are certain issues here, you know, that stuck in my mind in terms of education. One gets the impression that there are certain clauses in the National Credit Act that are now starting to work against us. Obviously, I do not want to open a floodgate to return to the old exploitation, which the Act was interested in closing, exploiting the ignorance of the customer and so on, overburdening people with taxation. But I'm sensitive to a situation when the education is prejudicing the interest of social development. Could you perhaps highlight certain aspects, clauses there in that legislation that need a relook? I mean, no, to amend legislation is not as difficult as amending a constitution, because we make laws that are practicable, desirable for social progress. Thank you.
Do you want to comment on that comment? Slip on it.
I think we've had very good conversation around this, because we're also sensitive. The design of the NCA did not have NISFAS in mind. So we're bringing a very gentle reminder that there's also NISFAS, and maybe there could be exemptions here and there. And to the extent that those exemptions can be achieved, we don't have a problem with the trust of the legislation. So let's see what happens with that.
I don't know. This statistic worries me. When you say there are 1,000 students out there, that is one institution who are locked up. And when you say 30 million, it's not that it was 30 million. It has been accumulating. I do not know. To me, that is a real crisis. Something needs to be done. I don't know why. Maybe I'll call to the board and we'll assist where we can assist. But to me, something needs to be done yesterday in order to for the benefit of even that is very crucial. Because when that kid gets the certificate tomorrow, he gets employment. After getting employment, everybody becomes better off, including the institution.
Thanks ever so much. I think the meeting is adjourned. Remember, you are invited for lunch. You can go across just here now. So it is almost ready now. Thank you ever so much. Members, so that we don't get lost next week. Next week we are dealing with the department annual report. It's a joint meeting with MCOP on Tuesday. So we are meeting at M46. M46.
Thank you.